This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on May 10th, 2012. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good morning. The open session for Thursday, May 10th, 2012 will now come to order. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes for the April 26, 2012 meeting. Madam Vice Chair, do you have a motion?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that we approve the minutes for the open meeting of Thursday, April 26, 2012, as set forth in agenda document number 12-32.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion passes 6-0. What we're going to do is Commissioner McGann's going to depart the room since he's recused from the first. Oh, right. He's going to leave the dais because he's. I forgot we were in an executive session where he does leave the room. And then we're going to discuss the Feinstein matter. And so, Madam Vice Chair, are there any late submitted documents for this advisory opinion request?
Just for this one. Okay. Yes. Well, for only this matter, I move that we waive the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents so that we may consider agenda documents 12-23A and 12-23B.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? The ayes have it. Thank you very much. And so the next matter on the agenda is draft advisory opinion 2012-7, Feinstein for Senate. I see we have Mr. Elias here with us today. I'm not sure if we have any questions for you. You're welcome to join the table, but I just don't know yet if we have questions. Ms. Selenkoff from the Office of General Counsel.
Thank you, Chair Hunter, and good morning, Commissioners. Agenda document 12-23, which was held over from the April 19th open meeting, and new agenda documents 12-23A, designated draft B, and 12-23B, which is designated draft C, respond to a request from the Feinstein for Senate Committee. The committee is the authorized committee of Senator Dianne Feinstein, and the committee asks if it may accept additional contributions from contributors whose funds were embezzled by the committee's treasurer without the additional contributions counting against the contributors' per election limits. The draft that was held over from the April 19th meeting and draft C both conclude that contributions from contributors whose funds were cashed or deposited into any bank account must be aggregated with any new contributions, but the committee may accept replacement contributions for those contributions whose funds were never deposited into any account or cashed. Draft B concludes that the committee may accept replacement contributions from contributors whose original contributions were not deposited into the committee's accounts, cashed, or otherwise used by the committee, but that the committee may not accept such replacement contributions from contributors whose funds were deposited into a committee account or cashed. We did not receive any comments on the request. We received one comment on the draft from the requester, and we received supplemental material from the requester following the last meeting at which this was considered. I'm available for any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments? Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I said at the last meeting, I think this is a very difficult question, and it's a very sympathetic request. It comes down to whether, as counsel said at the last meeting, he's not asking us to waive contribution limits. He's asking us at what point the contributions were accepted. And after thinking about this for a long time, I've decided that I think it's just sort of from a common sense and how the word reads in the dictionary perspective that it's hard to say that the committee accepted a contribution that it never actually got hold of in any meaningful sense, that never actually got into its accounts. But the ones that did go into its accounts, I think, yeah, they accepted those. They deposited them into their bank account. It's hard to say they didn't accept them. So that's not a terribly satisfactory answer, I think, for the requester, and I'm actually not even sure that it does you a whole lot of good. because I don't know whether, it's not clear whether between now and the election, when it would, when you'd have to be doing the additional fundraising, you'll be able to identify the checks that, or the I guess people don't write checks anymore, the credit card contributions that never made it into the accounts. But, you know, with that caveat that I'm not sure how much good it's going to do you, I'm prepared to support draft B.
Any other comments? Commissioner Walther?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have any idea, not that it has to decide the case one way or the other, how many checks or how much money was diverted before it ever got into the Feinstein account?
Commissioner, I think, I'm not sure if this is on. Can you all hear me? Okay. As I said last time, I don't think we have our arms around that with any specificity. We continue to... I'm not sure we know that with any specificity. We continue to work through that ourselves with, and also with others to try to get our arms around that. But I think to the extent draft B more closely draws that line that the vice chair mentioned, I think it's I think it may offer some relief.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll continue. This is a tough one because the cleanest, I guess, way to say is if it never gets in any account, this is our letter from before. We don't have it, we're not confronted with the issue to the same degree, so we have to draw a line if we're going to draw it somewhere. If we don't stick to that policy, and I think I can support draft B. I think it's a rational way to try and do this. In either event, we have to try and figure out a rational approach toward interpreting some what we normally consider fairly commonly understood words like accept and that kind of thing. But I can support draft B. And I'm not saying that draft C isn't reasonable. I think it is, and I think it probably started off in that direction and thought that in this particular case, it, and seeing what the rationale could be to provide some kind of relief here, I can support draft B. I would add a couple of things. There are a couple of areas where I would like to make some suggestions. This has been coming at us all pretty fast and back and forth. And I think that I want to try and take a look at a couple of areas to maybe clarify my own mind. But in theory, I'm willing to support it.
Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you. Obviously, this is a sympathetic situation. I'm going to be supporting draft C. A couple of the concerns I have about the approach in draft B, I think the footnotes so to say that. Sorry, not the footnotes. So if we treat the contribution that was diverted into somewhere else as not being accepted by the committee, but as I understand it, would still need to be reported by the committee. I share Commissioner Weintraub's view that it seems like this might be a very difficult endeavor, but I'm not quite sure of the implications of saying that there's something that if Ms. Durkee diverted funds from a Feinstein account into another candidate's account from which, so it was embezzled before it ever reached the Feinstein account, does that mean that it was accepted by the other committee, and would it be then a contribution to that other committee? I'm struggling with some of the implications of what drawing this line between receipt and acceptance really means in terms of other committees and other accounts that things might have gone into, either at the outset or at a later date. And obviously, draft B's distinction is on the first part of those, first type of those contributions. So I'm going to be supporting draft C, which says that if the contributions were never cashed or otherwise never left the contributor's control, then they could be resolicited, and that's consistent with what the commission has done in the past, I think. So, but I think that this is a difficult situation, but I think, unfortunately, from my perspective, we're bound by what the reg and the statute says and what we've done in the past, and I can't quite see myself, quite see clear to get to draft B.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. I, too, am planning on supporting draft C. I do so reluctantly, not because I think that it reaches the wrong legal result. I think that the reasoning is correct in that draft. But I do so because I do wish that that we had better tools at our disposal to address a situation like this. This is a situation, I think we all agree, it wasn't contemplated by Congress when the act was being drafted. You know, the relief that's being sought, permitting replacement contributions for funds that were embezzled, that's not something that the drafters of the act had in mind. Now, that fact alone is not dispositive, since there are many scenarios that we have to address in the advisory opinion context that deal with situations that weren't contemplated by the act. In fact, that's one of the main purposes of the advisory opinion process. I think, as I mentioned last time, the commission doesn't have broad authority to craft equitable remedies for in response to wrongdoing. In this case, it was committed by a committee's treasurer. Instead, we are constrained by what the act allows us to do and by what commission regulations permit us to do. And I think, like all of my colleagues, I've spent a lot of time going through the language of the act, of the commission regs, of the relevant advisory opinions, to see if there was, you know, a way that we could permit replacement contributions. And I've just really struggled to conclude that the funds that were embezzled by Kindy Durkee were not in fact received or accepted by the committee. Under the act, each committee is required to have a treasurer. Without one, you can't make make expenditures, receive contributions, and in fact, every committee expenditure has to be authorized by the committee, by the treasurer. It's the one indispensable position within the structure of a committee. So almost by definition, a person who's appointed as a treasurer is authorized to receive contributions on the committee's behalf. So while Kindy Durkee certainly was acting outside the scope of her authority when she was stealing from the Feinstein Committee and when she was shifting money to other clients' accounts, it's difficult for me to conclude that she was similarly acting outside the scope of her authority when she actually was receiving and depositing the contributions that had been made out to the Feinstein Committee. The restatement on agency does contemplate scenarios where an agent or an employee is both acting inside and outside the scope of their authority, and under the restatement, acting outside the scope of one's agency in some instances doesn't necessarily nullify that agency for all purposes. And I think in this case, that's what happened, that certainly certain actions by Kindy Durkee were outside the scope of her agency, while others or within it. At this point, I just want to mention that I appreciate the additional comments and the efforts made by Requester's Counsel to find a way to figure out a way that we could potentially circumscribe boundaries that would keep this from going too far. Last time, one of the concerns I had was about a limiting principle, and Requester's Counsel proposed three limiting principles to be applied to cases where committees victimized by embezzlement seek to obtain replacement contributions, and those were a criminal conviction or a guilty plea or some finding of guilt or liability, an intent to defraud that was in place before contributions received, and that replacement contributions would only be could only be sought for the current election cycle. And as I thought over these, while there's no doubt that these would narrow the circumstances under which replacement contributions would be able to be obtained in embezzlement scenarios, I was concerned that I wasn't sure whether or not they really are grounded in the act or that they would necessarily be equitable. To me, if the when the intent to defraud a committee isn't necessarily, if it happens at the time when money arrives, excuse me, or happens after money arrives, in either case, a committee is being victimized by embezzlement in either instance. And so I'm not sure that I would have felt comfortable drawing a line in that at that point. And also, other than administrative convenience, I'm not sure why we would want to, if we were going to go down the road to allow replacement contributions, why we would want to limit it just to the current election cycle. And also, I think that this was something that was brought up last time, is from an evidentiary perspective, if we were to go down that road, it would be difficult for the commission to really ascertain how much a committee would be able to recoup via replacement contributions, especially if the extent of the embezzlement depends, at least in some part, on the treasurer's subjective intent. And also, just from a very practical perspective, if we were to use these limiting principles, I think that they would disadvantage some candidates more than others. For example, House candidates are subject to only a two-year election cycle, and so the likelihood of discovering an embezzlement scenario and obtaining a conviction or a guilty plea all within an election cycle would be very unlikely. Senate candidates with their six-year election cycles, there would be a greater chance of that happening. So, again, it's just not clear to me how workable and fair these limiting principles would work. So, to my mind, it's kind of an all-or-nothing scenario. We either are all in or we're all out. And maybe I'm looking at that in too much black and white, but that's where I've arrived. If we were to throw open the door to all committees who have been victimized by embezzlement to obtain replacement contributions, then I really do fear that we would be opening Pandora's box, that we would be forced to do a lot of ad hoc line drawing, and we'd be governing an area with not a lot of guidance from the Act, that we would in a sense be creating policies out of whole cloth rather than just doing what we normally do, which is fleshing out the statutory scheme. So it's for these reasons that, again, I reluctantly plan to support draft C, and later on in this meeting we're going to be talking about legislative recommendations. Obviously, I think it would be too late to tag this on as something that Congress ought to consider, but I do think, you know, there on a very gut level, I think we all here on this on the dais have really been struggling with this issue and want to find some way to make it work, but again are constrained by what the Act allows us to do and by what our regulations permit us to do. And so that's the situation in which we find ourselves, and again, under those circumstances, I'm planning on voting for draft C.
Well put, Commissioner Peterson, and you took a lot of the words right out of my mouth. I agree with everything you said and also with what Commissioner Bowerly said, and I too plan to support draft C. Any other comments, questions? So I think the plan here is we're going to vote on those drafts, and my understanding is that the deadline for this, and thank you for your comments that you submitted, and also for extending the deadline to Monday, I think that's correct, Monday, May 14th.
She tells me yes.
The lady in the red glasses. Okay, so Monday, May 14th, which gives us a little bit of time to, because obviously there's some parts of this we'll be able to answer with the requisite amount of votes. So we'll put together a consensus draft and circulate it by tally vote, and it'll be done by Monday, May 14th. Are there any motions? Madam Vice Chair?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to note that I respect my colleagues for who've come to different conclusions. I think we have all agreed that it's a difficult situation. And I've been thinking about how we can sort of shake up the political class to try and make sure everybody is really aware of the scope of this problem. It's so troubling. I almost feel like we need to have a flashing light across our website saying X millions of dollars have been embezzled from political committees this year. Do you know where your money is? These old commercials we used to hear when I was growing up. It's 10 o'clock. Do you know where your children is? Do you know where your children are? It's really the scope of this is frightening. But having said that, I move approval of Draft B, which is Agenda Document 12-23A, along with technical and conforming amendments, because we did catch a couple of typos.
All those in favor signify by saying aye. Oh, Commissioner
Lawson. I'll support Draft B, but I did want to make a couple of suggestions with respect to the content, minor ones. So I certainly support the result in 99% of the
But we're,
draft,
we're voting so. On the draft right now, so we're not going to be rewriting it afterwards. There's something you wanted to.
Well, I thought we were going to try and maybe finish it off on a tally vote, you know, what we support or not.
You're not prepared to vote right now on draft B. Maybe you'll not vote? Or
I prefer not to, but if there's only one vote and that's all I get, I'd vote for it.
Well, I think we're going to have two.
I'll support it.
Okay.
Let's move it.
Okay. You'll get another chance to vote on the consensus draft. All those in favor for draft B, which is a document number 12-23A, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion fails 2-3. Are there any other motions? Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Thank you, Madam Chair. I move approval of agenda document number 12-23-B, otherwise known as draft C.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion fails 3-2. Mr. Elias, do you have any questions or technical questions about what we're going to do next? Or
I do not.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a brief recess at this time to get Mr. Professor Zolt on the line for the next draft advisory opinion, which is Repledge 2012-8.
Madam Chair, we have Professor Zolt on the line, so whenever you'd like to reconvene the meeting.
Thank you very much. Then we will reconvene the meeting. Welcome, Professor Zolt.
Thank you, and thanks for the opportunity again to prepare to be before the commission.
Thank you for joining us again. I don't know if you're – well, we have a motion first for a late submitted document, Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move we waive the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents so that we may consider agenda document 12-21B, which is a draft C answer to Repledge's request.
Professor Zolt, I don't know if you've had it. Oh, yeah, there's a motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion passes. Professor Zolt, Madam Vice Chair just moved, one of the documents she just moved is, as she said, is a new draft C that was just released a few minutes ago. I don't know if you had a chance to review that.
No, I have not. I've been looking on the web page, and I'm not sure it's posted yet.
We not fax it to him? Do we not fax these things to...
We email them usually. We email them to the requesters.
Was this email?
I would need to double-check downstairs.
No, I didn't receive an email. I sent an email to the secretary asking to get a copy.
Okay. Well, the document was just released at 10 o'clock. I apologize. I assumed that somebody sent you a copy of it. So I don't know if we want to continue the discussion and then maybe take a recess for the professor to take a look at it, or we could do that now and reconvene. I just, you know, look, there's a, I actually haven't even looked at it because it just came out as well, and we're going to be voting on it or at least talking about it this morning.
Do you want to move on to the rest of the agenda?
Madam Chair, does it make sense to move this agenda item further down and give me an opportunity to review the document?
I think that makes a lot of sense. This is a document. Does anybody want to give him an overview of the sentiment of the document before he takes a look at it? Madam Vice Chair?
Happy to do so, although I think, you know, it was my understanding that we routinely do when a new draft gets put out, that it gets, first thing that happens is it gets sent to the requester.
I don't even know if he probably would have had just a minute to look at it anyway,
But I do think it's a better idea to move this to the end of the agenda so you actually can read it. The major change is, I think, in the answers to questions 6 and 7 and I guess 8 changed as well.
You said 6, 7, and 8?
Yeah,
okay.
6, 7, and 8. One of the drafts, I think it was draft B, from the last discussion had operated on the assumption that that WePay would not be an agent of Repledge, and as a result some of us thought that Repledge was not acting as a processor of the money, and that raised corporate facilitation issues, although the fact that they weren't acting as a processor of the money took it out of the conduit regulations. Having now learned that they are that WePay is functioning as an agent of Repledge, that kind of switches the analysis. So it solves the facilitation problem, but creates a problem under the conduit regulations. So it flips the answers. Draft C flips the answers on the facilitation and on the conduit question.
Okay. And then on question 8?
Question 8 has become moot, basically. The answer is moot because having, since this draft answers question 7, that it is a conduit, that...
Then there's requirements to file.
Yeah, that's a problem.
Okay, then let's move it to the end. Give me an opportunity to read the new draft and see how this differs from the platforms presented in Democracy Engine and Giving Sphere.
Thank you once again for your patience, Professor.
Okay.
We will
and I'll call in do you have approximately what time?
Let's say it's about 10:40 now, about, just to give you a sort of a definitive time, should we say 11:30?
Okay, that works fine.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Commission is back in session. I believe we have Professor Zolt on the line. Professor?
He can hear us, but he can't speak.
Chair Hunter, can you hear me okay?
Yes, yes. Thank you. Thank you again for your patience. I know you'll describe your experience with the FEC as a delightful one.
Chair Hunter, I feel like the last 40 minutes has been a final exam type situation. And I think I appreciate more giving the exams than taking them.
Yeah, I guess we'll see how you do. It's an oral exam. And it's probably finals week, too.
Today's the last day of finals. Tomorrow's graduation.
Oh, well, this is a perfect timing for you then. Excellent. So did
you days from that one?
Yeah, really, it would have been nice to wait until you were done with all of that. But anyway, here we go. So you had a chance to review Draft C, Professor?
Yes, I have.
Okay. And I suppose we'll go a little bit backwards and hear from the Office of General Counsel. Mr.
Okay.
Lutz?
Thank you, Chair Hunter. Good morning, Commissioners. Agenda documents 12-21, 21-A, and 21-B respond to an advisory opinion request followed by a repledge. Documents 12-21 and 12-21-A were held over from previous meetings. Repledge is a corporation that proposes to establish a web-based platform that would allow individuals to remove pledge funds in equal amounts from opposing candidates for federal office and instead donate their funds to charitable organizations. The Commission received one comment on Draft B. Thank you, and I'm available to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Anybody have any comments on the advisory opinion? Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Professor. I'm sorry that we kept you waiting, actually, to get a what I believe will actually not be an any more satisfactory result than what we could have given you a couple of weeks ago. But I can only assure you that I tried. I spent many, many hours over the last few weeks trying to thread this needle and come up with an answer that I thought would work. And the problem is, I mean, the big problem really is, I think, is that we need desperately to update our regulations. The conduit regulations were passed in 1989, I believe. Not a lot of contributions were being made over the internet in 1989. It was not something that was really contemplated by those regulations. And in this area, as well as in a number of areas that involve electronic transfers, we have talked about this sort of behind the scenes, the need for a rulemaking to update our regulations and bring them into the a little bit more into the modern world. And this is another example of how they really don't work very well for the way business is transacted today. The problem that that I faced in this is that unless WePay is considered an agent of repledge, it did not seem to me that repledge was providing the kind of processing services that the Commission in the past has found would remove the transactions from the corporate facilitation rules. And that's where we were at the last meeting. Having clarified now that WePay actually is functioning as an agent of repledge, that solves the facilitation problem, but it kind of gets us into the soup on the conduit rules, because then repledge is actually taking earmarked contributions and passing them along. I had thought that this was quite analogous to Democracy Engine, but we did a little bit more digging on that, and Democracy Engine seems to have modeled itself on Act Blue and set up a political committee and is using the political committee as the vehicle for moving the political contributions, which of course eliminates the they may have conduit reporting issues, but they don't have a conduit bar, because it's not the it's a political committee that's moving the money, and they're allowed to. I just couldn't figure out a way to say yes to everything on this. So I will be supporting Draft C, but I also would like to work with my colleagues to see how quickly we can get moving on a rulemaking on electronic transactions, because we really, our regulations are hopelessly out of date on that front.
Okay.
Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be supporting Draft C for the reasons that the Vice Chair mentioned. I do think that this is your request factually presented us with some new aspects of this that we haven't really gotten to before. And of course, the challenge really comes down to, when thinking about this corporate facilitation versus the conduit piece, is that the exception for commercial vendors for corporate facilitations is corporate facilitation is broader than what you need to be the exception for conduit, which is a commercial fundraising firm retained by a committee. So that's where this distinction seems to fall out, even though I think at first blush it would seem that these two provisions would seem to require a similar result. And I just wanted to add one note to what Commissioner Weintraub mentioned. While the Democracy Engine Advisory Opinion didn't address this conduit issue, we have looked at the reports, and it does appear that they are reporting the earmarks flowing through their SSF. So that may be the way that they have squared that circle, and there may be other models out there to do that, and if those are attractive to you, of course, those would be available as well. But as currently constituted, I see the challenge on the conduit piece, so I'll be supporting draft C. Thank you.
Any other comments? Commissioner Walther?
I support draft C as well, but I just wondered if the professor had any comments that he'd like to make on any of these issues before we vote.
Thank you, Commissioner Walther. I do have a couple of comments, and I did have a quick review. I guess I'd like to start off by saying that the FEC has been rightly praised by their willingness to embrace emerging technology and use of the internet in a way that do not present possibilities of corruption and aid in transparency. And part of what we were trying to do at Repledge was to construct a completely transparent platform, and one that would minimize any chance of some of the issues presented in the Feinstein opinion earlier. I think my major comment, commissioners, is I think it really is a false choice between are you either facilitating or are you a conduit. And I think the key is that we are not really receiving and forwarding funds, and we never do take possession. I think the key is what we're doing is we are using WePay as a processor. We're just hiring a processor. And while Democracy Engine may have a non-connected PAC, GivingSphere is actually the identical platform that we're using. And I haven't been able to confirm it, but I'm pretty sure GivingSphere uses WePay in the same way that we intend to do it. So what we're doing is we're really processing contributions. We're not receiving and forwarding it. And I think that's a really key difference. And I think there's also, and maybe this is semantics, but I think it's important semantics, a difference between hiring an agent and hiring a vendor. And while as I'm a tax professor, not an election law professor, and I suspect agent has key words here, we're hiring WePay as our vendor to process the contributions. And it'd be no different than in earlier days of having a lockbox and a checking account and using a financial institutions to go forward. So I think the key part is we really are identical to GivingSphere in the way we structured our operation. And that advisory opinion was really just in November or October of this past year. And I guess my final comment is we set this up as a nonpartisan, bipartisan effort to reduce campaign spending. And it really is going to be over $2 billion in the presidential campaign. And it seems somewhat strange that our answer is that if we structure ourselves like ActBlue, the FEC has no problem with setting up an operation to raise funds in order to reduce the amount of funds going to political committees and just setting it up as a way to get more money to charity. And I think our only objective here was to provide a service to our members to identify people with opposite political views who share a commitment to their candidate, but want to say something about how the campaign finance system is broken. And it seems to me it really is broken if your answer to me today is go back, set up a non-connected committee to raise funds in order to divert funds from political candidates. So I know I'm rambling on, but for me the key issue is I don't think you have to either be a facilitator or a conduit. And I think the commission has ruled in GivingSphere that you can do it without having to follow the Act Blue route of being a non-connected PAC. I don't know if that's helpful in your considerations.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have, and perhaps you've already answered this, but since you know that I haven't had a chance to examine this draft with as much care as I would like, but explain to me again under the answer to question six, they aren't facilitating because we find that they're a commercial vendor with respect to the candidate committees.
Commissioner Peterson, can I just interrupt for a second?
Sure.
In our comment that we filed, what we set forth is arguments to say that, you know, first of all, we were not a fundraiser, that we were not set up in order to raise funds. And second, we argued that we're not facilitating in the way the facilitation regulations were set up. We're not using corporate-owned resources or union space to do that. And then our third argument was the commercial vendor argument.
Right.
So I agree we are retaining WePay, and we are providing a limited service to the committees, and therefore we fall within the commercial vendor exception. Okay, I'm sorry for interrupting.
Oh, no problem. That's a good clarification. Just for the record, I plan on voting for draft A, which would give you the answer that you're seeking. The question I had, and here's where you're at a bit of a disadvantage not being in the room. I was actually asking for some clarification from my colleagues who are supporting draft C, just for my own understanding. The conclusion in question six is that they're not facilitating because they fall under the commercial vendor exception, but in seven, they can't avail themselves of 110.6's commercial vendor. What is it? 110.6B2. Well, I won't run it. We're for a commercial fundraising firm retained by a candidate or the candidate's authorized committee to assist in fundraising. And perhaps you address this, but it looks like you're saying that they can't be. They get out from under potential facilitation because they're a commercial vendor, but they aren't a commercial vendor for purposes of conduit reporting. I just needed a little clarification on that.
Yeah. Commissioner Peterson, can I add something to you? I think the key phrase is receive and forward earmark contributions, and I don't think Repledge is doing that. I think Repledge, and I don't think WePay is receiving and forwarding contributions. They're processing contributions, and I think that's a key distinction, and that's why I think it's a false choice on either you qualify under six or go down under question seven. So it's clear we're never commingling funds. It's clear we're never taking possession. And I don't even think WePay is taking possession of funds. I think WePay is acting as a superhighway, providing electronic transfer facilities exactly as approved by the commission and other advisory opinions.
Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to answer my colleague's questions about the distinction, but I think I need first to go back to one of the reasons that we were able to say that you were acting as a commercial vendor is because you told us that WePay was your agent. And WePay, you told us, or pay, I think WePay is the only one at issue now, was going to be handling the processing of the funds. And whether you want to describe processing as the same thing as taking possession and transferring the money, in campaign world, that's what happens. We have this, there's a premise in the law that the money that is going to a candidate's committee or another political committee is tracked along the way. And I agree with my colleague that the conduct rules are were designed in a day when that meant I handed a set of 10 checks to someone and they passed them along to the campaign treasurer or someone at the campaign. So I fully hear the need for updating. But that doesn't change the idea that whatever is happening to the money is happening to campaign money, which is different in our setting than the rest of the money in the world that it gets to operate without these constraints. So a commercial,
but if we really do extend it out, Commissioner Brawley, then the language and variety of opinions that the services are akin to delivery service, bill-paying service, or check.
That was actually my next point, Professor, if I could just finish. And I know you're not in the room, so you can't necessarily see us. And I have been told that I pause in my answers quite frequently. Yeah. I think it's I've been accused of being Midwestern in that way. Or I would just say I claim being Midwestern in that way. The difference is between the conduit issue and the corporate facilitation issue is that, yes, we have frequently said that commercial vendors of all sorts fall outside of corporate facilitation, and that could be vendors for processing funds. It could be vendors for other things. The challenge is when you get into the conduit area, it is a much narrower exception. It requires a commercial fundraising service, so only fundraising services fall within that. And what as I understand, in not quite the same words as I understand Repledge is going to be doing is processing these funds. So they could be a commercial vendor for the purpose of processing the funds. That does not mean, in fact, the professor and in the request have specifically said that they do not intend to be raising funds, so they could hardly be a commercial fundraiser. In fact, the goal, of course, is to divert funds. Although I would note, when one goes to the beta site, and I did take an opportunity to do that, the first thing you're asked to do is make a pledge to a political candidate. And then the next step, I believe, is to identify a charity that you would like your funds to go to if it is matched by someone from supporting another an opposing candidate, and so the funds would wind up going to charity. Those are the distinctions that exist in the definitions that we have to work with.
Any other comments or questions?
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Chair?
Sure.
Can I ask if we decide to restructure operations and set up a non-connected committee, then hypothetically would the commission have no problem with the conduit rules? So if we really did structure ourselves as Act Blue, we could then try and succeed in diverting funds by setting up a political committee?
Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I mentioned earlier in my comments, there are a number of different models out there, and certainly Repledge could avail itself of those. The challenge, of course, in the conduit issue is that you are a corporation, and so therefore prohibited. So it seems to me, and this would be either something you might want to consider revising or coming back to us with another opinion, because, of course, we can't tell you anything based on the request before us. But I would note there are a number of models that not only the, and I don't think my colleague suggested Act Blue as any suggestion that there's any reason that partisan organizations have any benefit to this. This is available to anyone who wants to engage in this type of activity, but there are a number of models out there. And certainly the commission would always welcome another request from you to answer any of those other if you chose to do that, to find another model to answer that question.
And just one more question, Chair. If we set up as a trust rather than a corporation, would that be an acceptable model for avoiding the conduit regulations? It seems like what we're doing is creating additional paperwork and steps, and maybe it's required because of the interpretation of the conduit regs. But if we're a trust, then we would no longer be a corporation.
Right, and I think this is Commissioner Hunter. What Commissioner Bowerly was trying to say is it's a little bit difficult to answer the questions on the fly without everything presented in front of us. But I think one option to you is certainly there are people here at the FEC, including in the Office of General Counsel, who'd be happy to walk through different suggestions for you. I mean, obviously, they're not going to be able to know exactly where commission votes, but the agency has many people available to the public to walk through different scenarios, and we'd be happy to consult you in that way. And maybe that would help you decide what, if anything, to do going forward. I think Mr. Herman, who's our general counsel, has a comment.
And of course, if Professor Zolt wanted a formal opinion, he could restructure and then submit an additional advisory opinion request.
That's right. But in advance of that, if you wanted to consult with somebody before you set up your formal advisory opinion, certainly the commission would be available to do that as well.
Yes.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Any other questions or comments? Commissioner Peterson.
Yeah, no other comments than to say that I'll be planning on, if the professor... just for his interest, I plan on actually voting for draft A 12-21, which provides yeses to his proposal. And I don't have the same concerns that my colleagues have on this for the reasons that are set forth in that. And so at the appropriate time, I'll make a motion to vote for that as well. Okay. If the time is appropriate now, then, Madam Chair, I will therefore move to approve agenda document number 12-21 and with respect to draft advisory opinion 2012-08.
Thank you, Commissioner Peterson. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion fails 3-3. The Chair, Commissioner McGann, and Commissioner Peterson voting yes, and the Vice Chair, Commissioner Walther, and Commissioner Bowerly voting no. Are there any other motions? Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I want to emphasize for Professor Zolt, because I know you may not be that familiar with the way things work around here, but we don't actually, you know, generally entertain questions on the fly from requesters about how to restructure things. So you really, if you want, I don't want you to take more than was intended from anybody's comments at the table. If you want further advice, you're welcome to submit another request, and we will be happy to consider it again. But the only request that we are considering is the one that was submitted in writing. So
I appreciate that.
I don't want to send you down the garden path here. With that, I move approval of draft C as set forth in agenda document 12-21B.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion fails 3-3, and it's the opposite vote as the last one was. Professor Zolt, thank you so much.
Thank
you. Oh, sorry, Commissioner Walther.
Now that we voted, Professor, I think I don't want to discourage you either from taking a look at the kind of the bumps in the road that we've been facing and rethinking some areas along the lines that we had concerns and coming back at some point.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Thank you, Professor Zolt, for your patience and for joining us two different times. We very much appreciate your input throughout the process. And I think you got an A on your oral exam today. We were well prepared and threw out a lot of good questions with little time to prepare. So you can tell your students that you did quite well.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. The next matter on the agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2012-16, Angus King for U.S. Senate. Ms. Selenkoff?
Thank you, Chair Hunter. I believe we have a late submitted document.
Another one?
Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that we waive the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents so that we may consider agenda document 12-23.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes.
Just for clarification, 12-33 is that agenda document.
Oh, what did I say? 23? Oh, I'm sorry, 33. I apologize.
Thank you.
Ms. Selenkoff?
Thank you, Chair Hunter. Agenda document 12-33 responds to an advisory opinion request by Angus King for U.S. Senate campaign and Pierce Atwood, LLP. The committee and the law firm ask whether the firm may provide pro bono legal services to the committee pertaining to FEC compliance, even though the firm is a federal contractor. They also ask whether the firm's partners, associates, and other employees individually may volunteer for the committee without the firm providing the committee a prohibited in-kind contribution. The draft concludes that the firm may provide pro bono legal services to the committee pertaining to FEC compliance. The draft also concludes that the firm's partners, associates, and other employees individually may volunteer for the committee as proposed. The commission received one comment on the request, and I'm available to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments? Is there a motion? Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move approval of agenda document 12-33, a response to Angus King for U.S. Senate campaign and Pierce Atwood, LLP.
Thank you. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion passes 6-0. Thank you very much. The next item on the agenda is Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on the Legacy Committee Political Action Committee, A09-22. We have Mr. Hintermister, Mr. Bonowitz, and Ms. Nerthen at the table. Please proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before you is the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on the Legacy Committee Political Action Committee, which recommends you approve two findings as presented in the draft final audit report. The two findings presented were misstatement of financial activity and failure to file notices and properly disclose independent expenditures. For the first finding, misstatement of financial activity, the committee amended its reports to materially correct the misstatements as recommended in the interim audit report. For the second finding, failure to file notices and properly disclose independent expenditures, the committee's response to the interim audit report provided information regarding its position that the purpose of its direct mail letters was fundraising and did not require reporting as independent expenditures. The committee's response to the draft final audit report did not provide any additional comments with respect to this issue. We're prepared to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments? Should we see what Professor Zolt thinks? Commissioner McGann.
Thanks. Finding two. Regarding independent expenditures. Make sure I understand how we ended up where we ended up. The The Legacy Committee, they're a PAC, right? Okay, thanks.
Correct.
That's what I thought. Okay, so the PAC reported $1.1 million in change on Schedule E. So they've characterized that much as being independent expenditures. But in the course of the audit, once you got a hold of the actual communications at issue, the view was that not all of those were really independent expenditures that need to be reported as independent expenditures, but some of them still are.
That's correct.
And that's where we are. Oh. And let me guess, they're either independent expenditures or not because of our favorite topic, express advocacy. Everyone nods. Okay. Let me ask counsel or the auditors, whoever wants to answer. What's public is the draft audit report. What is not in the audit report is a breakdown of which communications are express advocacy and which aren't. But at the end of the matter, the public will see that there was an analysis done and there's a memo that sort of lays out what is and what isn't and why. But that memo is not public sitting here today. Or is it? Because I don't see it on the blue paper on the table. I don't want to get ahead of myself and start talking. I want to make sure we all play by the same rules and I know what I can talk about.
Commissioner, the specific analysis of specific communications was contained in our response, our analysis of the interim audit report, and that has not been made public. It would not be made public until the end, under Directive 70, until the end of the process.
Okay.
The committee did not raise arguments about particular communications, but raised general arguments in response to the interim audit report that advanced the proposition that fundraising communications should never be treated as independent expenditures. And so in our analysis to the draft final audit report, we didn't repeat the communication by communication analysis. We addressed the arguments that had been raised by the committee. The analysis to the draft report, I think, was not attached to the ADRM.
That's
Is that correct?
Correct? Mm-hmm.
So it has not yet been released.
It will be eventually.
Either, but it certainly will be eventually.
Okay. So if I talk specifically and reference it, am I in bounds or out of bounds?
I think
point?
You are in bounds if you
okay,
reference
so we're
that
not
one.
Saying this is still privileged or right. Right, this is going to go public, so we all agree this is, even though no one other than those who've seen the memo are really going to know what I'm talking about until they see the memo.
That's correct. Okay. There have been instances in which I'm pretty sure the draft analysis, the draft was attached to the ADRM. And has gone out with that.
Thank you. The committee then makes a general argument that fundraising solicitations don't require independent expenditure reports. The argument, unfortunately, the way they couch it, seems to turn more on subjective intent. You know, they didn't mean to influence an election. They meant to solicit money. And that doesn't really accomplish much of anything, because when it comes to independent expenditures, it's not really the subjective intent that governs. It's the content of the actual communication. But that doesn't mean that their conclusion's wrong. It just means they may have gone about it. They may have gotten there through a less, let's say, to be kind, a less preferred means. But the first question really is, do fundraising solicitations require IE reports? And I have to say, I'm not sure. On the one hand, let's assume a fundraising communication does say vote for Joe Smith for Congress. That seems to be something that would require an independent expenditure report. But what if the what if it's a fundraising piece where there's 10 pages of issue discussion and we're talking about everything but express advocacy, and then in the tagline, usually the direct mail has like a P.S. after the signature, P.S. Rush's for contribution, because we really want you to help us defeat so-and-so and defeat, so, you know, no matter what standard one applies, there's express advocacy in some part of it. It seems like an easy end around to say that you don't have to do an IE report, because then you could see a piece that really is a lot of express advocacy, but that the converse is true, where the tagline says, and by the way, call this person and tell them to cut taxes. Oh, well, and give us money, right? So it's kind of a variant of that. It wouldn't be the call and cut taxes. It would be the, by the way, give us money. And I guess you could see the absurd notion, even though people already seem to feel put upon by the I was just going to say the new McCain-Feingold disclaimers, which are now about 10 years old, but the stand-by-your-ad stuff already cuts into a 30-second ad, but you could see someone, you know, wasting 3 seconds in a 30-second ad, taking the bark off the tree, and then saying, and give us money. Well, that's a solicitation. We don't have to do IE reports. So that's it, once you sort of put that straw man up and burn it down, it seems that it's very tough to say that fundraising materials that contain express advocacy are never subject to IE reporting. It's too easy to end run that, and that just doesn't seem to pass muster. The more difficult situation comes up in the converse, where there may be language that could be, if standing alone, express advocacy, but when read in the context of the larger piece. And the context I'm talking about is the actual language of the communication, not external context and all that kind of thing, but the actual context of the piece is not really express advocacy, but it's more driven to raise money, or it's a statement of fact, or it's comparing policy positions of candidates and all that. And we have a lot of that here. But the first concern, before we get to the details, is I'm hesitant to vote for an audit that declares some of this stuff is definitely independent expenditures that would require independent expenditure reports, because I think the commission has never been all that clear. I think at a certain point, simply because it's a fundraising piece doesn't exempt it out from IE reports. But there has been some play, shall we say, in the joints of the rule. On the one hand, there's MER 5809, Christian Voter Project, where the commission did find reason to believe and then conciliated and settled the matter for failure to file IE reports. And I think the issue there was, well, the respondents said they were solicitations. But then you have MER 5518, the Hawaii Democratic Party, where pieces did contain express advocacy. OGC recommended finding reason to believe not because of express advocacy, but because it was promote attack support opposed done by a state party and therefore should have been paid for with hard money as FEA, federal election activity. And the commission decided not to do RTB no further action, but dismiss the matter. And there were a number of statements of reasons, some of which had absolutely nothing to do with the merits of whether or not IE reports were to be filed, some of which maybe could be read by analogy. And from that statement, I could see people could get somewhat confused, because one statement of reasons said that had this invitation, meaning the one at issue in that case, been mailed more broadly than it was and in sufficient numbers to raise questions about whether it was a bona fide invitation, or if it was really just a fundraising or advocacy piece masquerading as an invitation, this would be a different case. Which shows that there is a distinction between, at least in that case, a fundraising piece that a few commissioners said, look, that's part of the state party convention expenses. You need to invite people and you need to let people know, so that's part of it. but it makes it sound like even if it was that, maybe if it was sent more broadly and maybe if it was there was a question whether it's a bona fide invitation for a convention, whatever that means, or whether it was just a fundraising advocacy piece masquerading as an invitation, whatever that standard means, somehow that makes it different. Now, the facts weren't there, so it's but that gives some confusion. Now, you could say, well, that's FEA, that's a different situation. But when you have a PAC like this, which is not a party committee, they don't seem to have really thought through the IE issue completely. And I say that because they reported things as IEs that folks at the FEC say are not IEs. So even FEC folks say they really didn't understand the standard. It seems like the commission needs to say one way or another. And I think it needs to be clear, and it can't be a sort of you know, what I guess I could call dicta, even though the FEC doesn't really have dicta, but to make it clear that it's not like a binding rule. But when you see language like bona fide invitation and peace masquerading, I know what they mean by that. If I were in the same position, I probably would have wrote the same statement of reason. So I'm not criticizing the use of those terms, but I think there's a second step the commission needs to do, which is to provide clarity to folks so they know that they have to file IE reports for certain solicitations, because I think once people know, they will then think to look for that. Now, the more sophisticated players, I think, do scrub their solicitations and pull out any magic words or words that can be read as or whatever standard one wants to use, and they probably take a rather broad cut to avoid even tangling with the FEC on the issue. But for those who really haven't been in the game and do this more part-time, when you're doing the solicitations of the sort in this case, you're more worried about passing yourself off as a candidate. You're more worried about making clear that you're not really the Republican National Committee or a national party. So to the extent there's legal scrub on this, it tends to be for everything but IE reports, because as people have argued in other contexts, people think of IE reports as dealing with TV ads and direct mail and phones and not the fundraising part, because you need to raise money to spend the money, and the IE report is on the spending of the money, not on the raising of the money. But they don't think, what if the content of the raising of the money actually is also a form of advocacy? So I think at some point, hopefully soon, the commission can figure out how to do this. I'm hesitant to declare that these folks broke the law, because I think the law is a little fuzzy. There's been other MERS, one since I've been appointed to the commission, that have gone. I think there's one in particular went 3-3 and raised the issue then, and now here it is in an audit. And I'm not really emphasizing that MER because I don't think it's really necessarily fair to say, gee, I caused confusion and now I think we have to fix confusion. I think that's kind of circular. So I think that at some point we have to say one way or another, because there is, I think, confusion out there as to what needs to be reported and what doesn't. And then once we say, then people need to file their reports. Now, in this case, the question is, second question is, what really is express advocacy and what isn't? And I must confess, I have no idea. I've read the memo that tied to the interim audit about what is and what isn't, and it's some I see where it's coming from. I'm not sure I agree that what is listed as containing express advocacy is actually express advocacy. My sense is there may be some of my colleagues who think that some of the materials that are not considered express advocacy may think are express advocacy. I think some of the materials that are characterized as containing express advocacy are perhaps the functional equivalent of express advocacy, but they're not express advocacy. What's interesting about this, if you look at the pieces and the timing, this was done early in 2008, and it's a lot about why Barack Obama and in particular Hillary Clinton are really bad news for the country. And one piece in particular looks a lot like the sort of thing that's Hillary the movie in Citizens United, which of course is not express advocacy but the functional equivalent, and that wouldn't require an IE report, but the legal memo says it comes within 100.22b, so therefore it would require an IE report. But the Supreme Court has said something different. Another piece is characterized as express advocacy. Piece 6, for example, letter 6 says, help stop Hillary Clinton. The legal memo correctly states that, but it doesn't finish the sentence. It then sort of makes it more of a policy sentence as I read it. So I'm not sure that letter 6 is express advocacy, even though it talks a lot about the election, talks a lot about candidates, talks a lot about the fact that this PAC wants to, obviously we know where the PAC wants to be on election day, but it's not the sort of express words of advocacy talked about by the Supremes in Buckley. So I'm not really sure what to do about this because I'm hesitant to vote for a finding where I know I don't agree with some of the predicate we'll call them sub-findings of what constitutes express advocacy and what doesn't. So I throw that out to sort of stay where I am. It's not an easy one because of the number of fundraising solicitations. I have, I think, most of them here, and I'm holding it up for those listening at home. It's a pretty thick-sized piece of New York City phone book-type size chunk of solicitations, and those who know solicitations know there are always many pages with graphics and splashy PSs and signature blocks and response devices. So it's quite a thick amount of thick pack of stuff. So I'm not sure what we do because it's an issue that has historically divided the commission. You have a committee that's characterized over $1 million of things as independent expenditures, but didn't file the individual independent expenditure reports. You have OGC and the auditors saying, well, they're actually not all independent expenditures. And then my guess is you'll have some commissioners saying, well, actually, some of them that the staff says here are not are, and then others like me say, well, the staff says they are, I don't think they are. So I'm not sure how we resolve this, but we could either talk a lot or we could figure out a short way to cut to the chase. I don't know how to do it.
Madam Vice Chair.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I don't actually think it's that hard. I mean, the individual decisions might be hard, but what to do, I think, is actually pretty straightforward. And we, at the interim audit phase, as Commissioner McGann alluded, I had identified a number of communications that the auditors had taken out of the mix that I thought ought to be in the mix. So I sent an email to my colleagues and I said, here are the letters that I think really are express advocacy and therefore do require independent expenditure reports. I completely agree with my colleague that we can't say that just because something contains a solicitation, it doesn't require an independent expenditure report, because then everybody would just tag on a solicitation to their independent expenditures and say, poof, no more reports. I agree with my colleagues. That would be crazy. So then it just comes down to a decision on each of these letters. And, I read them back at the interim audit phase, and I'm sure you've read them as to which ones contain express advocacy and which ones don't. I think some of them are pretty plain. Some of them contain phrases like, Barack Obama must not win this election, or elect John McCain for president. I mean, some of this stuff is really classic express advocacy. I am prepared to vote for the audit report today, because although I would have included more communications, I agree that the communications that are referenced in this report are express advocacy and did require independent expenditure reports. Now, if my colleagues want to identify the ones on that list that they don't think are express advocacy, then, we end up, as we frequently do, with the common denominator. There must be some of them that, unless you're saying that you don't think any of them ought to be or express advocacy and require independent expenditure reports. It seems to me that if you identified the subset that you think are express advocacy, I think all of them that have been identified by the auditors at this point are express advocacy, so that we would end up with the ones that you agree on. I wouldn't suggest we do it here at the table, but it doesn't seem like an insurmountable task.
If I could.
Commissioner McGann.
I kind of anticipated that's what you would say, because I played it through on my mind and I figured ultimately you come back and say, well, tell us which ones you think are express advocacy, and that's, and then the burden, then I got to figure out what's express advocacy. Let me ask about two pieces in particular, because I don't know if the Commission's ever really said this before, but pieces 34 and 35, the reason why they're express advocacy, I don't think is because of the content of the communication, but because the carrier envelope says John McCain for president, which is a campaign slogan, which if that were on a yard sign, that would be an IE. But if the carrier envelope says it, does that convert the whole thing inside to express advocacy? I mean, it's, if you have a letter, multiple parts within, stapled in one part, there's law on that. But the outside of the envelope, does that, to the, on the reply carrier envelope, there's two different pieces. One's the mail going out the door, one's coming back. What do we do with that? Is that, and then what's the value that has to be reported as an IE if we say that there's some IE reportable event there? Do we know?
You want,
has the Commission ever said?
I don't believe the Commission has ever said, but we viewed it as the whole package as part of the communication.
Mr. Herman?
Conversely, if you have a letter that says vote for John McCain, but the envelope is just a plain vanilla envelope, you wouldn't say, well, you wouldn't parse it in that way. And it seems to me that applies where you have a carrier envelope that says vote for John McCain, but the letter doesn't necessarily contain the statement.
I hear you, but I'm not sure it's the flip side of the same coin. Because let's say you have a piece where there are, for the sake of argument, three completely separate parts within the mail piece, right? Let's say this pack sent a piece that said whatever they said, and they sent a piece that said, we're really looking to also elect state candidates, give us money for that. And there's a piece that said, you know, Repledge has this great program. We'd like you to check it out. Not to mix them up, just to, you know, keep the mood light. Does the whole entire cost of everything in the envelope then become an independent expenditure? I mean, I'm kind of thinking Emily's List in a way, where the Commission tried to say if the solicitation said, give us money so we can defeat so-and-so, that somehow that presumed all money received was now hard money. D.C. Circuit said that's not the case. I see that as, and this is not, that's not logical thinking, it's associational thinking. You know, I'm not saying it's the same thing. But to me, I'm not sure the Commission's ever said as a matter of law, the carrier envelope determines everything that's in the content. And so it's not so easy to say, well, you know, it's up to this side of the aisle to determine whether or not, not that we have an aisle, but this side of the dais to determine what's express advocacy. Because, again, I don't think the Commission's ever said what to do.
I think that's certainly the case. The Commission has not rendered an opinion on this particular issue. I think that's true.
Okay. So the question then is, do we in an audit announce for the first time that's now the new rule, or do we sort of say it's the new rule but then do a statement of reasons that then, you know, in 2 years somebody else says, well, you know, that wasn't clear? Or do we try to figure out a way to make this clear going forward and not necessarily ding this committee for something that the Commission's never really said is a problem on these two pieces? I don't know the answer to that.
Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that the challenge that you're identifying is that committees are incredibly creative about how they go about all of their work, and I don't think we could possibly have a rule for every kind of communication that someone is going to think of and be creative about, and I don't think we should. I think the question is there express advocacy? And I open this envelope, and inside I have a couple of pieces of paper, one of which says John McCain for president. Seems to me it's part and parcel of the same thing.
Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also think the converse would be completely unworkable. I mean, are we going to tell people that when they file their IE reports, they should weigh the different pieces of paper or count the lines or do some kind of weird allocation of what they, which lines they think contain express advocacy and report the value of that. I mean, they all have to carry a stamp or a permit, whatever kind of mailing. I just think that that would be incredibly complex and would be quite cumbersome for committees to have to work with.
But there's been a time-space allocation rule for 35 years, and that's been workable. I mean, people can split costs. Half the piece is, there's two separate pieces, and I'm saying there's like staples, and there's no question there's separate pieces in the envelope. Let's make it there's two pieces. So maybe half is the IE, half is not the IE. People do IEs where they talk part about a federal candidate and part about a state candidate. They have to split the cost. The whole value is not the IE. It's done on time space. The commission's been doing that for years. It's not unworkable. It's worked just fine. And remember, before one of the Shays cases made the FEC change the rule on the, I think it was a 20% rule. But there was a practice that was developed where, in order to do door-to-door and hand out literature, some state parties. And I learned this after the fact because I didn't come up with this one, but the person who did got really the gold star for creativity, where they would take basically five pieces to hand out. Four were rumpled up photocopies of state candidate stuff, and the fifth was a bright, glossy federal candidate piece. And they'd hand it out. They'd say, well, one-fifth of what we're doing is federal, so therefore we don't have to pay for the handing out with hard money. True story. You're shaking your head, but that's what somebody. Actually, the idea of splitting up things was even alive and well post McCain-Feingold. Didn't make it right, you know. Kind of, you know, that if the court would have known about that one, they probably would have gotten that Shays opinion done even quicker. But it raises the point that you can split this stuff out, and when I hear having a rule is unworkable when it's tied to a reporting regime. How do you have a reporting regime that doesn't have sort of clear standards ahead of time? Unless, well, we do it this way, where after the fact we say, guess what, you should have done your report.
Madam Vice Chair?
I think it is clear. It contains express advocacy. It requires an IE report. I think the only question is, you know, you say you don't know how to proceed. I could make the motion. It's your call whether you want to vote that none of them required IE reports or some of them required IE reports. If you need more time to identify which ones you think required the IE reports, I guess we can hold it over. I had asked the chair to put this on the agenda because it's been sitting around for a while, and I thought, you know, we ought to just reach a conclusion on it. An old one. We're talking about, you know, the election between John McCain and Barack Obama. We really ought to finish this audit.
Commissioner McGann.
Unencumbered by where my colleagues are on this, if you make the motion, I assume the motion would be to adopt the audit report as written.
That would be my motion.
And we play this out, and let's say that goes hypothetically 3-3, and then this issue would move to the other issues, and then we move it along that way, right?
Should we break down the motion finding by finding?
I'm just making sure that we all understand, and counsel's nodding, yeah, that sounds like what would happen. I'm just procedurally making sure. Maybe ask the chair, and if chair wants to ask counsel if they agree with that, that's fine.
Counsel?
Yes, we agree.
Okay.
Is it all going to other issues or just finding two?
Yeah, the problem is part of the misstatement is tied to finding two, right? Can I ask the auditors that? Or it's not. It doesn't seem. It seems like the misstatement is just a typical misstatement. You didn't lump in the IE issue into the misstatement finding.
No, I don't believe we did.
No.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Herman?
Could we consider a procedural issue moment among ourselves briefly,
sure.
please?
Sure.
Thank you.
You know what, I think the best thing to do is, because we've told Professor Zolt that we were going to call him back at 11:30 Eastern, which is in 5 minutes, and I haven't had a chance to read draft C, I think we should take a recess, reconvene at 11:30, call Professor Zolt, do that advisory opinion, and then come back to this and the other matters on the agenda. I need to read this draft before we get him on the phone. Thank you. The next matter on the agenda is revised guidebook for complaints and respondents on the FEC enforcement process. Mr. Guerra, would you like to say anything, or
excuse
the
me.
Document speaks for itself?
Excuse me, Madam Chair, we have a late submitted document.
Okay, thank you. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that we waive the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents so that we may consider agenda document number 12-34.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
I believe the document speaks for itself.
Thank you, Mr. Guerra, and thank you very much for help for revising the document for us. I just want to take a minute to thank Commissioner Walther, who was the original drive behind putting this document together back when he was the chair, and it's served as a very useful guide for the public and something that we've been able to point to as an accomplishment that provides guidance to the public on how our processes work. So thank you for that. And this version of the document has added, I believe the count is 7 different policies that we've adopted since the policy was originally enacted. So I think that's a testament to the fact that we as a commission keep trying to improve the process through various policy iterations and directives, and I think all of that is a step forward for the public, and I know we will continue to do that, and the Office of General Counsel has said that they are working as we speak on an updated enforcement manual. So thank you very much. Any other comments? Commissioner Walther.
I was wondering, do you have any idea what kind of clicks we get on this document? You have any, is it starting to get attention?
Not off the top of my head, but
yeah.
I can get that information by the end of the day.
Okay, well, not a big deal. I was just kind of curious to know if you knew. I mean, it'd be interesting to know if it's actually being accessed. Or maybe... Where we might want to put it on the website where people can get right to it if they want.
Any other comments? Excellent. Is there a motion? Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that we adopt the revised guidebook for complainants and respondents on the FEC enforcement process as set forth in agenda document number 12-34, and make sure we get it up on the website where everybody can find it.
Thank you. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion passes 6-0. Thank you very much. The next matter on the agenda is the draft 2012 legislative recommendations. We have
Thank
a
you.
Presentation by Mr. Dwayne Pugh, who is our Director of Congressional Affairs.
Yes, thank you, and good afternoon. The draft legislative recommendations for 2012 before you today reflect input from all the commissioners and from throughout the agency. The 5 recommendations are electronic filing of Senate reports, making permanent the administrative fine program for reporting violations, fraudulent misrepresentation of campaign authority, conversion of campaign funds, and authority to create SES positions. These recommendations are consistent with last year's, with the addition of making the administrative fine program permanent. Currently, that program applies to reports filed through the year-end reports for 2013, which will be due in January of 2014, and this recommendation seeks to make that program a permanent part of the Commission's enforcement tools. We recommend that the Commission approve these legislative recommendations so that we may provide them to Congress and the administration, including specifically our oversight committees, the Committee on House Administration and the Senate Committee on Rules and Administration, and our OMB contacts, as well as our appropriations subcommittees. I'd like to thank the commissioners and staff for their contributions to this year's recommendations, including particularly Paul Clark, Dana Brown, and Kevin Dealey. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pugh. Any questions or comments? Mr. Peter Shellstock is here with us today from the Committee on House Administration. Peter, would you like to talk about any of the recommendations? He quickly said no thanks. Okay, hearing no comment, is there a motion? Madam Vice Chair?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that we adopt the legislative recommendations for 2012 as set forth in agenda document number 12-31 and wish Mr. Pugh Godspeed in persuading members of Congress to adopt these fine, worthy, and well-needed recommendations.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have. The motion passes 6-0. Thank you.
Thank you.
With respect to the last matter on the agenda, which is the Legacy Committee Political Action Committee audit, we're going to hold that over to the next open meeting. The discussion made us think of a couple of questions that we were trying to get the answers from the auditors, and it's probably best to just work on the list and reconsider at the next open meeting. Mr. Herman?
Just to correct my earlier statement, there's actually a directive, Directive 70, that speaks to the issue of whether to vote on individual findings, and under Directive 70, the Commission is required to make a finding by finding vote if there are not four commissioners voting in favor of both findings.
Okay, thank you very much. That's helpful. Excellent. Mr. Palmer, are there any management and administrative matters to discuss?
Madam Chair, there are no such matters.
The meeting is adjourned. Thank you.